Hi, this is Michael Harding here with Bill Roller of Beacon Rock. And Bill, I hear that you've been doing something pretty interesting the past couple of years. Could you tell me about it, please?
Well, Michael, it's Beacon Rock Wealth Advisors, started out as BR Capital. I'm Bill Roller. I do many interesting things, but one of the things that I've really been concentrating on was last year and this year, I decided I would enter a trading contest, and there are two divisions. It's the $20,000 and above dollars is the U.S. Investing Championships, and then for $1 million and above, there is the Money Manager Verified Rankings, and this is put on by a guy named Dr. Norm Zeta. Interesting guy. Has a PhD in operations research. I can remember reading about the U.S. Investing Championships back in the 80s when I would read Barron's and the Wall Street Journal. It kind of had a large following. Some very famous traders, investors came out of that, like a Tom Basso, very well-known gentleman who's still very active. In fact, in this year's Million and Above, Mr. Mark Minervini, who's one of my personal heroes. I read his books and reread his books. So it's very interesting. It's really kind of an interesting journey.
So how did you get started in that, though?
Well, Beacon Rock, we're an investment advisory firm. So, of course, I'm always trying to figure out how to make money for clients, you know, how to make money for myself, which is always nice. But along with that, trying to understand where does the super performance come from? You know, these guys that are like running hedge funds, you know, they're getting really, really great stuff. And in terms of my background, I had been in the Army for 7 years. I'd been an infantry guy, I'd been a special forces guy. You know, I jumped out of perfectly good airplanes.
For no good reason.
It seemed like a good reason at the time. You know, and other personal challenges, learning to fly and that sort of thing. Went to work for Merrill Lynch, a well-known stock brokerage whose mascot is the bull, kind of thing. And you know, they didn't really talk a whole lot about return back then. You know, any of the wirehouses, as they're called, were really just interested in how much production, how much commission revenue were you bringing in. So I started, you know, kind of reading about that. There are a number of classic books out there. Jack Swagger has written a whole set of books: Market Wizards, New Market Wizards, Stock Market Wizards, Hedge Fund Market Wizards. His most recent book is Unknown Market Wizards, which are all very interesting. So, you know, you kind of think about, okay, how are these guys getting these normal, these super returns, you know, without, you know, being hauled in for insider trading or something like that, or what, or, you know, how are they doing this without, you know, commissions just killing them or killing accounts? And so that's how I got interested more in terms of trading versus investing in order to get the return. Certainly, as the U.S. stock market has gotten more efficient, you know, it's become more volatile. But at the same time, commission costs have dropped, or at least they've become more invisible to the client. You know, the commissions costs are still there. They're reflected more in terms of bid-ask spreads and slippage, and you know, what kind of price are you getting from a brokerage versus what you can get in the market. You know, just as an aside, people say, well, how does Robinhood make money if they're not getting commission revenue? Well, they're selling their order flow, and they're making it off of, you know, bid-ask spread, or what I would term, you know, invisible execution, or costs that are invisible to their clients. But that's been going on for years.
So what is the competition called?
There are two divisions.
Right.
It's the U.S. Investing Championships, okay, for 20,000 and above in terms of account size, and then the Money Manager Verified Rankings,
okay,
for a million and above. And last year I came in second. Of course, that in the money manager verified rankings, but you know, that wasn't super, super great. You know, the client made 15.76% last year, you know, without trying to keep the risk low. For me, in my account, it went up 58%. Of course, I came in a little late, about 2 weeks late, in the middle of January. So my competition return was 39.6%. But to put, I mean, the guy who won it, Oliver Kell, brought in a return of 900%.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean he worked it. I mean he.
Was that for his account or for a client's account?
That was for, I think, for his account. Okay. You know, the one that, his personal account that he was managing. He's a Canadian citizen, you know, CFA, big strong technical analysis guy. Had obviously he bought a lot of Tesla, and mm-hmm. you know he was trading very aggressively on margin on both those. My accounts, I didn't use any margin. One was my IRA, the other one was just an unlevered account. But it shows what's possible.
Right.
Mark Minervini, again one of my heroes, has entered this year the Money Manager Verified rankings. Of course, he's probably running his own money for that, which allows him to take on some risk. He's up 111% so far this year.
And the Money Manager, that's one that's a million and above.
That's a million and above.
So 111%, did you say?
111%, yes.
On $1 million.
On $1 million. So
minimum.
Yeah. Probably, like I said, probably running his money. But I mean, he's written some very excellent books. And maybe it's, in some ways it's helpful to talk about kind of the history. How do you get there? How do you do that?
Right. Yeah.
Because it's in many ways so alien to what Wall Street does, at least in terms of its client accounts. I guess the thing to understand is trading is different from investing, or it's different from buy and hold investing. When I started out at Merrill Lynch,
at the bull,
when I started out this place known as the Bull, you know, it was really about stock selection, and it was the early, you know, the 90s, where the stock market was in such a strong uptrend. You know, you could be buy and hold, you could make stupid mistakes, and over time the market would bail you out.
Right.
You know, so even if you took an immediate short-term hit, you know, oh well, don't worry about it, it's going to come back. And there was so much money flowing into the market that would work. And of course, that kind of came to a screeching halt in 2000, as you can imagine. So, I mean, the way these guys, you have to get return, I mean, these supernormal returns, is by trading. Much shorter time frames, huge, much larger numbers of trades on a daily basis. I mean, Wall Street does that. They do it in their trading activities. They do it in their money management, market making activities. You know, if you're a bull, and you're managing Apple stock, you know, it's all algorithmic. You know, you may be doing 10,000 trades that day now.
Wow.
In Apple stock. You know, that may be low.
Yeah.
And you're taking little bits of every transaction. So where these guys, where a trader tries to make money, really is in finding an edge in the market and then rolling that edge. And the more he rolls the edge, you know, the more the money will compound and the faster it will grow. Mr. Minervini, you know, in his book says, you know, you're going to be times when the stock you sell is going to go out and be a five-bagger, but you keep it on a relatively short time horizon, and you're just trying to capture the move of the stock. He's, you know, in his holding period might be anywhere from a few days or, well, a few minutes if he gets stopped out of it, to maybe 3 months might be considered long term as the stock's making a major move.
Well, if you don't mind, let's go back to something that you said earlier.
Yeah.
Because I think it's just is awesome, number one, and fascinating, number two. You said for your personal account, you had a 58% return, but for a client's account, you had 15%?
Well, right, so I was running two things.
Right.
So I was doing for my account in the U.S. Investing Championships, I had 58% that year for the whole year for that account. 39.6% is what counted because I came in, like I said, I came in late. And then I also had an account in the Money Manager Verified Rankings, million above, and that client paid 15.75% for the year. Again, unlevered.
Right, but the reason why that's fascinating to me, because what's the average interest rate in a savings account nowadays?
Oh, it's minuscule.
Exactly.
I think the S&P was up 8%. You want to do, you know, and we're trying to get better with that. And in a lot of ways, you know, it was very much a learning experience for me, because I had to really lose a lot of bad habits, I think.
Right.
I mean, and everybody has them. My biggest bad habit is I tend to hold on to losers way too long. That's just very hard, very hard time. I mean, it's very hard to admit a mistake, but I'm getting better at that. Maybe we can talk about some of the intellectual background of that. I actually brought some props with that. So, it's sort of like interesting how these guys go at it. Certainly the growth stock investing has really been the major way. There's a whole range of strategies that people are employing. I mean, there is actually a division that Dr. Zeta set up for derivatives. But it's for options and futures and all that. But it's interesting that the stock players have far outperformed the derivatives players. It's not even close.
No.
And that kind of says, you know, make more money in stocks than you can in options.
Mm-hmm.
I recently read something he wrote on Twitter where he said it was true in the 80s and it's true now. He's far outperforming what the supposed, you know, the wacky, you know, derivatives, you know, players are doing. So it's very interesting. But, you know, there are a number of classic books out there on investing. Warren Buffett, you know, the main guy of value investing, got started with Security Analysis by Graham and Dodd. In recent years, really since the 1970s, growth has tended to outperform value. There have been periods when value kind of shifts back for a little bit, and everybody goes, "Oh, value investing is back from the dead," and then it tends to go back to growth. The classic book on that, I brought my prop here, is "How to Make Money in Stocks" by William O'Neill. His big thing is the canned slim method, without going into everything, but he's looking for stocks that have high institutional ownership, very strong sales, a lot of insider buying, a new product. Back in the early 60s, he made a lot of money off of birth control pills, Centex. You know, he discovered that. He made a huge amount of money on eBay. He was buying a lot of eBay back in the 90s. Did well with that.
I'd imagine he'd look for something, you know, like Pfizer when it came up with Viagra.
Viagra, that's right.
Yeah.
When you're looking for something new, you're looking for new management, or you're looking for a new product, or, you know, sometimes even just being acquired can be thing, you know, some sort of catalyst to that. He's not necessarily looking for low PE. He's much more interested in strong, accelerating sales, which eventually will work their way into earnings. Amazon certainly was the one that, where they had terrible earnings for years and years and years because they were reinvesting so much, but they had enormous sales every year, which was certainly a big hit for him.
And William O'Neill, I'm familiar with his publication, the Investor's Business Daily. Investor Daily Business.
No, Investor's Business Daily.
Business Daily, yeah. I had to got it confused in my head.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a great publication for just a lay person like myself who's interested in learning about investing in the market.
It's actually now, well, the newspaper now comes out once a week, so it's not daily. It comes out on Saturday. They have a very good website, and they recently were acquired by News Corporation, along with, you know, they're in there with the Dow, Dow Jones, the Wall Street Journal, but they claim they're going to be run separately, so let's hope so.
Yeah. So what else do you have?
Well, one of them, certainly I mentioned Jack Swagger, Stock Market Wizards, excellent book, and here is an interview with Mark Minervini, very interesting character. Got some others here.
What is the premise of the Stock Market Wizards, though?
Well, what Swagger does is he interviews in his Stock Market Wizards. He's also written some very classic books about just commodities investing. You know, textbook on that, both fundamental analysis, technical analysis, managed futures. But he goes out and he interviews people who are putting the numbers up. And he doesn't necessarily go into great detail about what's happening in the market then. He's more about, okay, what's your strategy a little bit, or what's your, really, because a lot of these guys are doing what I term would be proprietary things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they sort of like, okay, what's the most important thing in there? You know, Mark Minervini, all the time, cut your losses. Be very rigorous about cutting your losses. And along with that comes with protecting gains. You know, there's a tendency to think that, A, you don't lose money until you sell the stock.
Right.
Well, you are, because you're marking the market every day. Mm-hmm. Whether you realize that, whether that gain or loss is realized or unrealized, it doesn't matter. You know, even if you're down 20%, and you still haven't sold, you're down 20% in your account.
Right. Yeah.
So you have to continually mark the market. Same way, he's very rigorous about not giving back gains with that, and that's, you know, again, things that I constantly struggle with.
So it sounds like he's talking about timing the market in a sense, because you're protecting your gains, but you're sort of minimizing your losses, and so.
Yeah, that's true. From the standpoint of, there are times, and all these guys are different from Wall Street, and they're different from what I learned in the land of the bull. In that there are times when they'll be completely out of the market, mm-hmm. when they'll be in cash, and you know, they're paying much closer attention to the health of the market, the breadth of the market. Are stocks going up? I mean, are the averages looking good or looking better? But at the same time, you can also suffer from what I would term index fascination,
right.
and they're focusing less on the companies and more on how the stocks are setting up. And that's really the major difference. I mean, we all fall in love with companies.
Right.
And, you know, we think we know companies because it's like, kind of like rooting for the NFL home team. When in fact, a good stock trader focuses on the stocks that are setting up. And when I say a setup, like it might be breaking out, it might be have high relative strength compared to the market. And in a lot of cases, the emphasis is on buy first, research later, or at least start a position. And I, you know, one of the things about reading these books and doing these contests, listening to these podcasts, when I got started, I really felt I was like kind of a one-off. You know, everybody thinks they're special or their problems are unique to them. The more you listen to it, the more it's like, the more you have in common with them, you know, because everybody struggles with it.
Right.
And it's a matter of overcoming those things, like, you know, gee, am I the only one who buys bad stocks? You know, as I tell clients, I've never bought a bad stock, but I've certainly sold a few.
That's true.
And so the thing is to focus on the setup with that. you know, and I guess along with that, there's a tendency to think that investing is this hyper-rational process, this very left-brain process, mm-hmm. when in fact it really is not. It's really more like the hunt, you know, or in some cases falling in love, which you have to be careful of because the endorphin effect can lead you astray. But it's kind of like, you know, a good stock when you see it. You know, you know a great person when you see him or her.
Right.
At least you think so.
Right. But until proven otherwise.
Until proven otherwise, yes. But in both cases, you know, you can be led astray. And so when you see the setup, okay, is it, you know, it's moving, it's breaking out, it's got 10 times the volume that you're looking for. Okay, then okay, what are the sales and, you know, sales and earnings look like? Whoa, you know, buy, you know,
yeah.
And then it goes up some more, buy, you know, goes up a third time, buy, you know, and then be careful, you know, and then continue to watch. And then you start seeing, you know, it's going up, 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 up. And then it's like, uh-oh, we're getting a little overhyped, sell some.
Right.
And that's the other major thing is they also know how to sell into strength. There's a tendency when you have a great stock, you know, it's like finding the perfect person. You know, you want to spend your life with it, you know, but you really don't, you know, because stocks get overbought, you know, they get overhyped. You know, Microsoft back in 2000, you know, everybody loved it. You know, of course, it, you know, went from like 60 down to 28, you know, and had to recover for 15 years before it started moving again. You know, so it's learning the setups, selling into strength, and sometimes just doing nothing, being willing to sit in cash while you wait, being able to hold on to the stock sometimes when it's bouncing around and, you know, you want to vomit, you know, but you hold on.
Yeah. You know, in your industry and my industry, they're similar. You ask yourself, am I the only one buying bad stocks?
Right.
Am I the only one that's being told no constantly when I go to interview to get a listing or, you know, try to gain a client? So we have that misery loves company, you know, think, am I the only one that's being told no constantly? And am I the only one buying bad stocks? So I understand your pain.
Well, yeah, and certainly in finance, you know, I think there's certainly been a sea change really in terms of like working for the bull. You know, when I started in the 90s, early 90s, you know, you had to be a great stock picker. You also had to be a great salesman. Well, those are two very limited skills, and the overlap is very tiny, which is one reason I think a turnover in the industry was so high. Now it's become, you know, you're much less of a stock picker at any of those wirehouses, and, you know, you're more of a client handholder. They all try and outsource the investing as much as possible. With the downside, of course, that you know, most people are basically in what I would term stealth index funds, because there just isn't the capacity, you know, in individual stocks sometimes to, you know, to put, you know, an entire $1 trillion client base in there,
right,
to get them the returns.
Yeah,
it's you know, without just blowing it through the roof. So, you know, you kind of continue to disperse that and hold too many positions, which. Certainly, you know, what I would term a stock market wizard or a good trader. I mean, these guys are, you know, you read they're starting out with maybe 12 stocks, and then over time they may be cutting it down to 5 in a portfolio.
Yeah.
And then they're riding them hard.
Yeah, because I've always heard it's best to be in a diversified portfolio. Mm-hmm. You know, not heavily relying on one sector or, you know, one company, but to go from 12 to 5, you're kind of limiting.
Yeah, well, there are different ways of cutting your risk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly, if you're marrying the wrong person, and you only get one shot at it, you know, you have huge amounts of risk.
Mm-hmm.
So you better choose wisely. Same thing if you're marrying a stock, and you're going to be holding it for a very, very long period of time. You know. But you learn also that no matter what your level of due diligence is, no matter how think you know the company, you know the management, they can still do you damage. You know, so the way you minimize that risk is by being willing to shorten your time horizon, you know, on that, both, you know, both in terms of how long you're willing to hold it when you're right, mm-hmm. and how short you'll hold it if you're wrong, if you're proven wrong. So getting back to William O'Neill, I mean, his big thing is, you know, you got to look for a very firm basis. You know, you don't, it's hard to jump, it's dangerous to jump in a stock that's extended.
Right.
What you want to see is a stock that's been basing for a long period of time, that's had volume come out of it. His whole thing is, you know, the cup and handle kind of thing, where you see it kind of, you know, the volumes come out of it and, you know, going down and then breaking out from there. Minervini talks about the VCP, the volume contraction pattern, where same thing, you see, you know, it's getting smaller and smaller, the average true range volumes coming out of it. It's had very good sales and earnings, perhaps, so it's on the watch list. When it breaks out, then you're on it.
I wonder what O'Neill's position was on Apple, because, you know, for a number of years, Apple was struggling, and,
right.
and oh my gosh, Steve Jobs.
Yep.
Was let go, then he was brought back.
Yep.
And then
Apple down to six.
Apple down, yeah. But then they came out with the iPod.
That's right.
And it hasn't been the same since. It just took off, and but then Steve Jobs passed away and Tim Cook slid in. But wasn't Jobs already kind of sort of on the way out because he was having health problems?
Yeah,
but
he was suffering from pancreatic cancer.
Yeah, but he was still recognized as the head of the company. And I remember when he passed away, the stock took a dive, but then it, you know, it bounced back.
Recovered. Well, one of the other things, certainly, in order to make decent returns, is you got to be in things that are moving.
Right.
So buy and hold may work for a Warren Buffett, but it won't necessarily work for growth stock investing. And you may be in and out of a stock. Minervini, you know, he's been in and out of stocks like five times, but you know they move up, then they start to base.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he'll be out of it if it's not moving. You know, so they go in again. Okay, so he made a million. Okay, it's flat. Take your million. You know, wait 2 years later. You know, put a million back in and get, you know, maybe up a little bit, but catch the next wave. And you know, stocks will tend to base, you know, five, six, seven times. Securities, if you read literature, you know, they spend most of their time moving sideways. So momentum says you want to be in the things that are moving and not in the things that are moving. So that's certainly one of the other things that I do in terms of all my accounts, at least the ones where I can, in terms of the brokerage providing the information, is days in trade become important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the return given the days in the trade? And if it's starting to fall, or you know, there's not much return, then it's like, okay, keep looking for the next opportunity on that.
Speaking of momentum,
yes,
I see your next piece of literature is Momentum Masters.
Momentum Masters, excellent book. A roundtable interview with super traders, and again, Mark Minervini, U.S. investing champion. David Ryan, another one, won it a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Ritchie also did well. He's a student of Mark Minervini. Dan Zanger is another guy on here. Very, very interesting gentleman. He runs a chart patterns. Is his website. Very interesting. He did pretty well in the 80s. Lost money also. Kind of did well. And then lost a bunch, and then kind of got back into it. One year, he's like the world record. He had a 23,000% return.
Wow.
You know, he was in every mover in the 90s, as you can imagine.
23,000.
23,000% return, yes. So you can imagine what that, you know, life-changing money doing that.
That's multi-generational changing money.
Yes. Yes, he phenomenal guy.
Holy moly.
But again, a lot of, you know, one of these guys, I mean, you're talking hundreds of trades a day,
right,
on that. Thomas Claro, who's high up in the rankings, this year. They did a story on him at Business Insider, you know, where he's actually, I think he's from Chile, and he, you know, he's buying, he's position trading kind of William O'Neill stocks. He's buying kind of the unknown stocks. He's buying some unknown Chilean mining companies. You know, he's also doing scalping, day trade, you know, kind of a range of strategies. And they say he was doing 150 trades a day. So, you know, that it's kind of amazing what these guys can do, you know, through focus and perseverance and, you know, some experience and,
yeah,
you know, but again, you're not doing a huge amount of stock analysis on there.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, because you figure with 150 trades or 100 trades or even 50 trades, you can't really devote a lot of time into, you know, doing your due diligence on a company.
Well,
at least to me.
Right. Well, you want to do enough fundamental analysis to know that you're not going to get killed if you buy it. But a lot of these things, you know, they can make very strong moves. You know, certainly in the under $5 stock range, they act almost like options. Mm-hmm. You know, they're very thinly traded. You know what's going on. I mean, with a lot of those, they're being shorted. And we did that interview on GameStop.
Right.
And GameStop was being heavily shorted, and they were pressing the shorts because institutions want to get short and stay short. And then if a stock basically can go bankrupt or stop trading, they'll never have to realize, they'll basically hold on to dead stock money. They'll never have to, in fact, realize that gain on their short. So they'll never be taxed on it.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have the cash, but they'll, you know, but they'll never do it. But when one of those stocks in that under, you know, $5 or under $2 range shows signs of life, suddenly the short's got to cover, and that's what blows it sky high, and that's what happened with GameStop. You know, it was a back from the dead play. So, you know, when you're looking for those back from the dead plays, they can be just incredibly lucrative.
Right.
You know, or one that came up recently, like TK Art. You know, the non-fungible token thing. It had a 1400% return in about 2 weeks.
Wow.
You know, just you know, the momentum came into it, and you know, people made money. I didn't, wish I had, but I'm looking for the next one.
Yeah. So what else is the concept of, I mean, do they give their strategies or their?
Well, I mean, the name of the book is Momentum Masters. So I mean, momentum is, I would term it a hybrid strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're basically looking for price momentum. It's like, what's going up? You know, is it? And it doesn't really matter. Is it a growth stock going up? Or is it a value stock going up? You know, is it cryptocurrency going up? It's like, where is the money flowing? You know, ride the wave. You know, surf the wave.
Does it matter where the money's going and where it's coming from, in your opinion?
I think so. If you can kind of identify that, it's helpful to see where it's not going.
Yeah, because the premise of my question, as I was listening to you, is because it's one thing if it's coming from Joe Investor like myself, but you know, the gentleman, the 23,000%,
yeah,
you know, investor, if he's looking at it, then that,
yeah, well,
you know, carries different level of weight.
Well, certainly, you know, the whole point of Can Slim is you're looking for the tracks of institutional ownership. You know, a William O'Neill, he's holding stocks for a longer period of time. You know, in some cases, years. You know, mm-hmm. eBay did well, Pick and Save did well, Syntex, that birth control, you know, multi-year thing.
Okay.
But he also kind of knew when to get out. You know, that's the main thing. So, you know, you're looking, if you go on to MarketSmith, which is kind of kind of a quasi-institutional offering from Investors, Business Daily, you know, it'll show kind of, okay, what funds own this own the stock. Mm-hmm. Is institutional ownership going up or going down? You know, ideally you want to find somewhere there's some early adopters, funds, you know, that are credible, that have a good track record, that are starting to put money into it. And then if you can follow them into the trade, you know, and hold on to it, you know, gives you a greater degree of perhaps safety on that. So big money buying is very important.
Right.
Back at it. So there are three things that really everybody looks at, and I'm not sure who wrote it, but what's really important is mindset, method, money management. Mm-hmm. are really the three things. I mean, most people tend to focus just on method, or you know, anytime you talk to people, it's what's the hot stock. You know, it's never about how do you manage the stocks once you get them, and managing the money becomes more important. As I said before, I mean, I've never bought a bad stock. I've sure sold some. You know, clients I think have never fired me for buying a bad stock, but they certainly have for holding on to them. You know, and it's that you got to get out of that hoping and praying mode with that. And you know, you just got to be, are the averages going up or going down? And sometimes you need to explain that to them, you know, because the pain of a loss, in some ways, of being wrong on a stock is, you know, they'd rather see their account values decline than take a loss. Yeah, you know, I want to see the numbers getting bigger.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of my goal. Yeah. Minervini's written a number of books on investing. Championships, you know, trading on that. One of the books he just wrote was Mindset: Secrets for Winning, which is very good, which is really more of a self-help book. But that's, you know, kind of like the personal power kind of thing in terms of that. But he applies it to stock trading. The two books that he wrote, Trade Like a Stock Market Wizard and Think and Trade Like a Champion, are the two stock market books. But this is the third book. And it's really kind of interesting how much mindset ties into this game. As I said before, I mean, we tend to think that investing is this hyper-rational, you know, just numbers flowing, and it's really not. It's much more like hunting or sports or in combatives. Mark Minervini is actually a championship shooter.
No.
You know, which kind of takes, you know, take dead aim at a stock and do that.
I was thinking that it sounds a lot like someone who voluntarily gets into boxing or MMA. You have to go in with the mindset, yep, that you're going to get hit.
Exactly.
And how much are you willing to get beat up on?
How much pain are you willing to take?
Yeah, yeah.
I was a fencer at West Point. You know, so you know, then there's that concept in sports of flow. You know, with that of being in the zone. You know,
right.
Sometimes when you're doing it right, you can't do anything wrong. You know, with that, and of course, the endorphin rush is, you know, very, very strong. And it's the same way with trading. I mean, sometimes the endorphin rush is so powerful, you almost have to step back from it. You know, it's sort of like, you know, but you also have to be able to shrug off those losses. You know, it's kind of like in fencing. You know, attack. You know, parry, attack, parry. You know,
right.
It's like hold, sell.
Yeah.
You know, hit, oops, loss.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You know, shrug it off.
Yeah.
You know, get ready for the next one, you know, and it's, you know, look for the setup. And so certainly early in my career, there's a tendency to take a string of losses personally, you know, or it's my fault. And rather than saying, hey, the market's telling you to get out and stay out, you know, listen to that, you know. If you're taking, like, four losses at a time, maybe it's not you. Maybe you just don't need to be there for a while.
Right.
You know, so that's when you sell almost everything, or, you know, most positions, and then you just kind of step back and say, okay, you know, what am I trying to accomplish here? You know, reevaluate and then try and get back into the flow of the market.
Yeah, kind of take a step back and observe and know. Because it's easier to judge how a race is going when you're not running.
Exactly right. I remember talking once to the council of Caxton, and Caxton is a big hedge fund kind of thing. It's like, you know, how do you guys handle, you know, a trading loss, traders losing money? He said, well, they had a rigorous loss control that if a trader went 5% below his bogey, I mean, they stopped trading, you know, and then, you know, they have to evaluate, okay, what happened, you know,
right.
So, you know, step back, all that, you know, how do you prevent it from happening again? You know, and that's why risk management in hedge funds, you know, certainly banks, is very important. You know, as an individual, that becomes even more important because you're your own risk manager.
Right.
You know, so.
And you probably don't have a program or whatever set up to keep track of how your investment is going, you know, minute by minute, because.
Well, some of them are getting better at that. I mean, Interactive Brokers is very good about that. Over time, one of the key lessons that come out is the absolute importance of keeping records, of knowing your positions.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, when I worked for the bull, you know, there was really no easy way of saying exactly how are you doing in every account. Over time, I think I get daily downloads from custodians that I use. You know, how's it going? So record keeping is very important. Dr. Alexander Elder, another kind of trading guru, says, you know, that the difference between an amateur and a professional is a professional keeps good records. And that's one of those things I keep trying to do better or find better systems to do that. You know, because there's also, you know, journaling. You know, what were you thinking about with that? What did the chart look like before you got into it? What did it look like when you got out of it? You know, why did you do it? You know, and then you have to going back and reviewing those trades is important. Same thing. Sometimes I guess you would term it. You know, what did Apple look like back in 2000 before its big run?
Right.
You know, would you have made the same decision? You know, if you got out of a stock and it went on to have, you know, to be a 10 bagger, why did you get out? You know, so those are the painful ones. And, you know, one of the ways to do it is, you know, you gotta force yourself to look at those things and take the pain. You know, it's like Tiger Woods, you know, or, you know, a football team reviewing its game films. You know, you learn a lot more from your losing games than you do
right.
from your winning games, you know, of what you're doing wrong.
Yeah.
How to avoid that. So that's same thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was thinking about that United States Investing Championship thing that you were
yeah.
doing. And, you know, using that football analogy, it's not necessarily the quality of your play, but the quality of your opponent's play that determines whether you win or lose. And so for you to do so well and that, because you're going up against some pretty sharp-minded people, it sounds like. And so kudos to you.
Yeah, well, it's like everything else. You kind of, you got to get better. A lot of it, you know, I like challenges. You know, even though I'm humbled by these people here, I mean, geez, what would I do with a 900% return?
Right.
You know, again, or even a, you know, a Zanger's 23,000% return.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
You know, on that. I mean, you know, it's part of that wanting to get better. I mean, certainly wanting to move the firm along. You know, because, you know, these guys get the interviews, and
yep.
you know, they're kind of like rock stars. You know, Oliver Kell, you know, who won it last year. I mean, you know, everybody's like kind of like a guru on that. You know, this Chris, I forget his name. Dumb Money was one of the unknown market mm-hmm. wizards. Very interesting. Chris Camello, you know, very very interesting guy. Runs. Highly recommend watching Dumb Money on YouTube. He He gets up there with a couple of his bros, you know, a couple of friends. You know, their thing is they took $30,000 back, you know, among the three of them, and turned it into $30 million.
Wow.
You know, and
in what time frame?
You know, probably about 15, 20 years.
Okay.
You know, Chris was a big options player, which, you know, his friend said it at one time, you know, you took some enormous hits on those options. He said, yep. but they're big into social investing. He wrote a pretty good book, Laughing at Wall Street. I don't have a copy here, but I got it from the library. He worked Silicon Valley in marketing, so he's very smart with like Google. He started a company called Ticker Tags, where he, you know, figured out okay what stocks are being mentioned. Well, he created an entire database, you know, of who are the stocks, the companies, the products, the management, all that in ticker tags. And then computers are sifting through this information for mentions of stocks and all that, and what's trending. And then, you know, that informed a lot of his investing process.
Wow.
You know, some of these people are just absolutely brilliant people.
Right.
You know, but, you know, you got to be disciplined as well as smart.
Right.
You know, and to do well with that stuff, you know, it's a weird combination. I mean, it's kind of why, you know, Wall Street to a certain extent laughs at MBAs, because MBAs are smart, but they're not necessarily disciplined.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it takes time to develop. It's you know, like being a second lieutenant in the
right.
Army. You know, they may be smart, but they just haven't developed the kind of street smarts out there. I mean, having been both, there are many parallels between the two. And you know, so you know, the MBA has got to develop that, you know, beaten up enough. It's not all in the numbers,
right?
You know, and the same thing if you're taking over a company, you know, just it may not validate your predictions, because people are people and they're unpredictable.
Right. That's very true.
I'm sure you see it in real estate.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, certainly I saw it. Got a few more books here.
Yes. What's the next one?
Well, let's just grab this one. This is kind of a classic, How to Trade in Stocks, Jesse Livermore.
Okay.
Livermore was an early stock market wizard.
Mm-hmm.
He was known as the boy plunger back in the 1920s. Made a lot of money. Made and lost several fortunes, made a lot of money on cotton, you know, lived the high life during the golden age in New York City. Unfortunately, committed suicide, you know, in 1946 in a hotel room, having lost several fortunes at that, which, you know, being neurotic is sort of a byproduct of being a trader, or,
yeah,
know, being a comedian, or, you know, any sometimes, so that did him in. You know, very interesting. There are a couple of books. You know, Edwin Lefebvre wrote a very good book about the life of Jesse Livermore. So really, when you talk about books, you know, you talk about, you know, Jesse Livermore. You talk about William O'Neill, How to Make Money in Stocks. You know, those are always in the, you know, Jack Swagger, Market Wizards. You know, those are always, you know, always in the top 10.
Right. Yeah.
And then there's kind of the next tier of books that are also very, very useful. This one shows up a lot.
Yeah, the one that I often hear about is The Intelligent Investor.
Well, The Intelligent Investor. Yeah, that's that was Benjamin Graham,
mm-hmm.
Who came out, you know, Graham and Dodd. Fame was the original version. There's another version that came out by Jason Zweig, kind of the new intelligent investor, which is very good. Which it tends to be more value investing based as opposed to growth. right. investing, but it's an excellent read.
Yeah,
highly recommend it. This is another one, a classic of growth stock investing. One of my favorites, How I Made $2 Million in the Stock Market, 1950s, Nicholas Darvis.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting character. Nicholas, and he was, this one really demonstrates kind of the ability to sit and not be overwhelmed by too much information. Nicholas Darvis was a dancer, of all things, and he taught dancing on cruise ships.
Wow.
So he, and there's a thing kind of called the Darvis box, which is kind of technical analysis, now where he was very much about buying stocks at new highs, which is counterintuitive, which is also very much a growth stock investing thing. You don't want to buy a stock when it's down because it can keep going down. Buy a stock when it's at a making new highs, fresh money. You don't have to worry about overhead supply. So Darvis made a lot of money, like on Texas Instruments in the 50s when it was getting going, that post-war electronics boom. And you didn't have stock tickers on the cruise ships then, so we'd kind of get the newspaper a few days late, or a few weeks late, calls broker, I'll call you back in 3 weeks.
Yeah, when we get to port.
Yeah, and made $2 million in the 1950s, which I think is the equivalent of probably like $20 million today, up there. So another phenomenal type return. He's written some other very good books Wall Street, The New Casino, kind of the 70s kind of thing, trying to recapture the fighter or something like that.
Right.
But all did well. And then kind of a last one, a few more. Oh, of course, I brought my copy of The New Market Wizards, Conversations with America's Top Traders, Jack Swagger. This was sort of the first one out there. It's kind of amazing. They're all stocks, commodities, options, kind of the whole thing. And then after that he started specializing kind of more in stock type trading as that came out.
And you read each one of these books?
Oh yeah, yeah. They're all very, very worthwhile. And some, my goal is to reread the William O'Neill books, and the Minervini. The Minervini books; those are kind of the big three to read and reread. Very famous investor Jim Roble says that he's read How to Make Money in Stocks, like 30 times.
Wow.
Goes through and highlights it. William O'Neill was doing investing seminars out there. And Roble, and they're relatively expensive too. Mm-hmm. I mean, like $4,000. Roble went, like twice a year.
Wow.
When he was a stockbroker, and then he started his own hedge fund, and he's also getting heavily into cryptocurrencies.
Mm-hmm.
Reading and rereading these things, Minervini has said, you're better off reading one book 10 times than 10 books one time.
Right, yeah.
And to a certain extent, you can get really lost in the weeds in some finance books out there. Particularly when you're talking about super duper portfolio theory or computerized investing and everything else.
Right.
This helps kind of stick to the basics.
Yeah, nice. Is there any other books that you?
Well,
this
last one I got, actually finding very useful, The Life Cycle Trade, How to Win at Trading IPOs and Super Growth Stocks. This came out, Eve Bobich, hopefully I'm saying that right. She's done a lot of interviews recently. This just came out last year. It's a relatively thin book, but it's actually very useful. She went and kind of looked at a lot of IPOs and kind of how they trade. There's a lot of hype that comes out about initial public offerings. So everybody wants in on that IPO,
Yeah, let me in at Facebook. When it came out.
And Facebook tanked after its IPO.
Yeah.
It was down. So in some ways there's a winner's curse associated with that, and people pile on kind of at the wrong time. Certainly some of the recent IPOs, Coinbase recently IPO'd at 250. First, and that was just this week. First trade was done around 384. Mm-hmm. It peaked at like 420, and now it's at 330, around there. So generally, you're better off waiting.
Right.
Snowflake was another big one that came out last year, which had a real high pop. You know, I think came out at like 250, hit 420, and then, you know, sold off to the 300s for a while. You don't want to be the person buying it at 420. Generally, she says, you know, they go through stages. You know, there's the initial pop stage, and it's kind of like a very long cup and handle sort of thing. There's the initial pop enthusiasm, and then a long kind of basing pattern where institutions, you know, kind of start doing their due diligence once it's out there. Mm-hmm. You know, I think most institutions, if they're heavily into it, they're gonna sell, take the profit right away,
right,
and then, you know, wait 6 months to a year to see how it performs, and then start buying back in at that point.
Well, yeah, it makes sense because, you know, usually there's a, you know, using a Facebook example again, there's a lot of interest in Facebook going public, and then when it does, then there's going to be a rush of people to buy, so
right,
it's going to drive up the price, but that doesn't mean that that's the value of that company.
Right, and it's usually retail investors who are hyping it at that point, and, you know, they Wall Street is happy to hype the hell out of it. The right. Insiders get their pop, they get out of it, they get sold, they get liquidity, and then when the last marginal buyer is in, there's only one way to go, and that's down.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting. But I mean, it's sort of like, okay, what have I learned from this process?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. But, you know, so how have you grown as a financial advisor by reading the books and participating in the competition?
I think that's too restricted. I mean, another book I recently read, very good, Brett Steenbarger, you know, is a psychiatrist, mm-hmm, and a Jim Roble. You have, in some ways, the point of trading is not to make money, it's to be a better person. So it's very Zen-like kind of concept. And of course, you can't delude yourself because you're looking at your numbers all
right.
the time, you know, and you're processing information. So you're trying to become a better information processor. One of the an excellent book that I'm just finishing listening to, probably the best self-help book I've ever read, is Steve Kotler, Art of the Impossible,
mm-hmm.
Steve Kotler has written a number of excellent books, Bold, Abundance with Peter Diamandis. Peter Diamandis was the guy who came out with the X Prize about sending the first spaceship to orbit and then reusing it within 2 weeks, $10 million, which was won by Burt Rutan. But Kotler is very big into extreme performance. The Rise of Superman and Art of the Impossible is just absolutely phenomenal. I cannot recommend it highly enough. And a lot of the whole trading thing is, you know, getting into flow. Same thing of sports, you know, flow. He's talking about, you know, jazz troops, you know, musicians as a group, how do they, you know, group flow. Very interesting. James Roble, you know, Jim Roble said, you know, what are you willing to give up in order to become a great, you know, a great trader,
mm-hmm.
you know, become a great money maker? Are you willing to invest in going to a psychiatrist, you know, to get rid of your issues? Because if you have a weakness of any kind, the market will find it,
right?
You know,
and expose it.
Yeah, and of course at the same time, sales will also expose both. You know, I told somebody once when I was starting to work for the Bull, it was like, you know, the interplay of trading and sales is like learning to juggle while you're riding a skateboard.
Mm-hmm.
Both are very difficult to do in isolation, and to do them at the same time is sometimes damn near impossible. And Collar makes the point, and I strongly that, you know, to get into flow, you have to control your anxiety as much as possible, because there are times when, you know, things are really going bad. You know, you got to focus. You know, your clients are counting on you. You know, keep it under control here. You know,
right.
You know,
despite their emotions.
Yeah, get focused. You know, understand what you got.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, trying to land an airplane in a very bad weather. You know, without much help.
The analogy that comes to my mind is trying to land an airplane on a blacked out aircraft carrier.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean,
during a storm on the high seas.
I've heard, you know, just the incredible fear of slamming that thing onto the deck.
Oh, yeah.
You know, totally counterintuitive. I mean, it's just, you know, somebody would say, if you want to lose the joy of flying, do a night carrier landing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of same analogy. But same time, you also, if you're really good at trading, you have to control the arrogance that comes with that, because a lot of, you know, because again, the endorphin hit is so strong, it's like you're king of the world until you suddenly you're not. I mean, I had lunch with a father son guy, and the young man has done extremely well on buying cryptocurrency. You know, I said, you know, you gotta worry about taxes, but B, you gotta control that sense of, you know, king of the universe,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, because it can really kill you. You know, that's why you have to, you don't just have to control your anxiety, you have to control your euphoria, and in some ways, euphoria is much stronger than anxiety. You know, because it's really that endorphin rush that Kotler talks about, which is also very dangerous. Because flow gives you that endorphin rush, but everything looks great when you're in that rush. You know, so it's like if you're buying, he just said, you know, if you're buying a wardrobe in that, you may think that 70s polyester is the way to go.
Yeah.
You know, so it's the same thing. You know, with stocks. You know, if you're doing impulse buying sometimes. Based on FOMO, based on fear of missing out, you know, you can make very bad decisions, you know, very quickly.
Kind of like proposing to someone after a first date. Because, you know, you were talking about the marrying a stock and marrying the wrong person, how it could have a drastic impact.
It's, right.
That kind of sounds like what it, you know.
A lot of, yeah, because it's the endorphin rush.
Right.
Certainly, you know, I saw a funny meme about, I hate to say it, Prince Harry and his wife,
mm-hmm.
and I'm on a lot of West Point friends, and it said it's terrible that a young man back home after a hard deployment falls in love with the first stripper he meets. So
that went along.
Yes. maybe I'll cut that part out.
No, leave it.
Yeah, but. But yeah, I mean, it's that endorphin rush is
right.
So strong. I mean, those systems are exactly the same. Another excellent book I recently read, the time between the dog and the wolf. It really breaks down the impact of how your body functions when you're trading.
Right.
And this guy had done a lot of work. Neuroscience of trading, you know, and why people get overconfident, and you know, all that. Why traders blow up, and you know, so that's what I think. I mean, you, as I said before, euphoria is much more dangerous than anxiety, because
mm-hmm.
anxiety will keep you out of some situations. Euphoria will keep you in bad situations.
Right.
You know, it'll be like, you know, hey, let's go swimming while you know.
With sharks.
Yeah, let's go swim with the sharks, or, you know, hey, you know, the high tension wires in the water. Well, that won't bother me at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's that fear, that lack of fear is more dangerous than, yeah, than fear.
Than fear itself.
Yeah. And I've said before that in some ways, fear of loss in the markets is very much tied to the same system that gives you a fear of heights. I have no fear of heights when I'm flying, but I have a huge fear of heights, you know, like doing those stupid 20-foot balance beams when I was at West Point, mm-hmm. you know, trying to do that. I just hated those things, you know.
I have a fear of heights when I'm like at the edge of a building,
yes.
trying to look down.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
But get me on an airplane, I can look down all day.
Not a problem.
Look at the scenery.
Something in the brain that does that. So,
yeah.
So that's some, you know, that's what I've learned. I mean, meditation is very important to control anxiety. Focus is important. you know, one of the things that takes you out of flow is toxic people, mm-hmm. toxic situations. You know, so in some ways, you know, I've had to get out of those things, which is great. You know, focus on what's important. You know, Shannon Roller, family, those things are important. You know, true friends are important. You know, other kinds of things. You know, meetings, organizations. You know, much less so. In some ways, COVID for me has been a real godsend. I saw a very funny cartoon. It was the kind of thing like, oh, nobody can go anywhere? Boy, traders are happy.
Yeah.
They're ecstatic. Yeah, it gives them more time to, you know, look for the next thing and
look
at their screens and try and figure things out and
right.
all that.
Yeah, that's true.
So I've been loving it, you know.
Yeah.
So you getting out of those things, you know, focus on what's important. You know, PT is become much more important for me the last few years, you know, losing weight, you know, because you got to have the mental energy to continue this stuff, and you know, you want to live long enough to enjoy your winnings.
Yeah, that's so true. So what does the future hold for you in terms of this competition? You said you entered again this year?
Yeah, entered again this year. I was doing great I was up 24% through the end of February. March was tough, up 11.8. I've got a ways to go to catch up with Mr. Minervini on that, on the other one, but so all you can do is all you just keep getting better.
Yeah.
You know, you got to focus on what, you know,
one foot in front of the other.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of ironic, you know, sort of, you know, you got to, you know, the more I trade, the better I do. So I'm looking for that sweet spot. You know, if you trade too much, you have low return. If you trade not enough, you have low return. So you're just always trying to find that kind of optimal point,
right.
you know, to maximize the return, where you're getting the return, you're turning the money, you're minimizing the drawdown. And so a lot of that, I think, is continuing to mine my data that I've got, you know, that I keep downloading every day, and then journaling, okay, what's working, and then trying to break it down in finer and finer things to see what's the insight with that. Because that also helps control the anxiety, because the more you understand where it's coming from, the more you can, okay, you know, when to press the accelerator, you know what's working, and then when to back off.
Yeah, when to apply the brakes.
Yeah.
So you were up 24%.
Yep.
And then down to 11.9.
11.9.
Yeah.
Around
it.
Yeah.
So that was March. So how are you doing so far in April?
I haven't really been tracking, but I'm up probably about 15% year to date. So about 4% so far. So again, keep turning it faster, because I got some catching up to do with these other people.
Yeah. And are you able to see how well some of the people that you met, Minervini?
Well, as I said, Mr. Minervini's up 111% year to date, so he's killing it. You know, on this Thomas Claro, who was leading for a while on the USIC, the 20,000 above, he's up 315%,
wow.
which is unbelievable. I don't know any of these others. His name stands out. I wonder if Oliver's in here. I don't see Oliver Kell on here offhand, who won it last year. I follow him on Twitter. I don't see him offhand. I think he's in there though, but you know, he was expressing some frustration. So.
And his picks or the what was his frustration source?
It's been an interesting, a tough market, really since February. I mean, middle of February, it was easy until then. Now you're just seeing some really vicious sector rotation. Mm-hmm. It's kind of ironic. The indices are up, they're hitting new highs, but it's like none of the stocks that people are following are in them. So it's right now, indexing would be a better choice than active stock picking, at least really since about the middle of March, which is frustrating.
Right.
But as I said, Minervini's up 111%, so something's working.
Yeah.
For him.
Yeah, for him.
So, it's sort of like, do it, figure out what he's doing and do it.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you, do you receive any report of what strategy he's using or which stocks he's, trades he's making?
I could. It seems like most of these guys now aren't really running hedge funds. Mm-hmm. They're running kind of private website kind of things. I mentioned Dan Zanger. Mm-hmm. Runs Chart Patterns. Minervini runs Minervini Private Access. He puts on a investing seminar every year in Myrtle Beach. I was considering going last year. He went online with it last year. He's going to go online with it this year. I think I'll do that. Mm-hmm. This year. Just again, that whole repetition is the mother of learning. Depending on how I feel about that, I might consider joining Minervini Private Access. Stuff isn't cheap. It's $5,000 for his investing weekend, but if you can make that up in a week or two, then go after it.
Well, I mean, 111% so far. What if you can maintain that for the year?
That's why I'm thinking that at least getting a seminar in November, that for $5,000, that might be the best investment to make.
Yeah.
The other thing I started doing really is taking a real hard look at the at cryptocurrency investing.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of what that is, diversification, which is very interesting. I want to do it very tax advantaged, so I went through the process of setting up a self-directed Roth IRA. Mm-hmm. Which kind of took a while because I had to set up a LLC with that. I used a company called Broad Financial, which is very helpful, and then Rotherized part of one of my rollover IRAs and all that, and sent that around, and then finally got that really set up for trading last week. It took about a month.
Mm.
And if you deal with the crypto exchanges, it's easy as an individual, relatively easy as an individual. As a LLC, you got to jump through many more hoops with that. You got to do it legally, so it took them a while. And of course, the a lot of money's flowing in there. Had the Coinbase IPO going on, so I basically didn't hear from them at all. maybe I probably will next week. They were like, "Well, we're really busy right now. We can't deal with it." So I'm looking at that. Crypto, as we saw, cryptocurrencies are very interesting. A lot of people make money in the early stages of a new financial asset.
Mm-hmm.
While everybody's saying, you're going to lose your ass on those things. People forget Warren Buffett was basically the cryptocurrency investor of his age. He was investing in small cap stocks.
Right.
When institutions said, "Oh, you should only own bonds, and we're going to be going into a depression." So he was the original, I would say Warren Buffett was the original cryptocurrency investor. And then certainly the guys that made money on options when they first started going in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
Paul Tudor Jones, on commodities. He's never make money on commodities. Paul Tudor Jones proved them wrong. The growth stocks, we discussed William O'Neill, value is the place you got to be. So same thing, you're going to see the dynamic in cryptocurrencies. So I'm looking at that. I'm a little bit struggling because I'm not quite figuring out what are the drivers of value in that.
In crypto.
I mean, because it's, okay, what's a valuation model that makes sense? I mean, right now the only valuation model that seems to make sense is if Elon Musk tweets about it, make sure I say that right. If Elon Musk tweets about it, then it must have value. Like we saw with Dogecoin going crazy over the last few weeks. But other than that, I can't really figure out, reading the white papers, is it what drives it? So I have to read that and get smart.
Well, that's just you're expanding, you're growing, your level of knowledge and understanding of a new concept. So
yeah, well, again,
it's growth and it makes you a better person,
right?
Because you mentioned that earlier.
You're looking for overlap, mm-hmm, with that. So I mean, the secret is be a better person, be a calmer person, be a better husband, be a better father. Don't let things bother me.
Right. Yeah. And I'm the same way, especially with my grandkids.
Right.
I'm trying to be the best grandpa that I can.
Right. So get better, be better, try and make other people's lives better.
Yeah.
If you can't, or they don't want to play, then
yeah, it's not the end of the world.
Look at your portfolio.
Yeah. Exactly. Like when I want to do something with my grandson. But he doesn't necessarily want to. Is it really the end of the world? Not really.
Yeah, no.
So I'm just trying to grow myself.
Go read a book.
Exactly. and there's plenty of books out there for me to read in my industry, the sales industry, because that's what a realtor is a salesman. When we get down to it. So I'm trying to dive into that.
Your job is 10% real estate, 90% people.
Yes, so. Absolutely. So what else is new and exciting for you other than, trying to grow, trying to
focus?
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
How's the journaling going?
Good. Yeah. I looked at using Trademetria. I'm not sure. Sometimes your self-built solutions are better. I mean, I use a lot of Microsoft Access. Mm-hmm. So really, I do a fair amount of programming, at least database-wise. I run I take a daily download of option information from the CBOE on stuff, just trying to understand the options interplay. I mean, intuitively, I think that there's a lot of interplay between stocks, options, social media, as we discussed,
right.
Understand that. I think really on cryptocurrency, it's crypto, kind of the fundamentals of, transactions and market cap and, gas and all that, cost of doing things and social media, so you're trying to look at the overlap.
Mm-hmm.
And, I could learn how to program this stuff also, programming crypto bots and all that, because trading really takes place 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Right.
That would be helpful. So it's trying to understand the liquidity flow.
Well, on that, because you said trading occurs 24 hours a day, do you look at foreign companies as well, or is it just primarily U.S. companies that you can have a better understanding of the management and the policies of that country, because it may be different in the United States than in Germany, than in China, than in
Yeah,
Japan.
Well, I'm looking, certainly I can buy the over-the-counter type foreign securities, and I have on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
For people, I mean, they tend to be the more better well-known ones, the larger cap names, just to limit the risk on that. They'll trade in the U.S. during, mm-hmm, U.S. market hours, so that's not a big issue. Some of the Canadian stocks, of course, you know, all that. So yeah, I mean, I will on occasion do that. I mean, generally, you're always trying to fight the home market bias with that, because I'm sure there are a large number of stocks out there, you know, that I'm not really paying attention to, but which I should. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, there are a lot of Chinese ADRs and other stuff trading on U.S. exchanges, and Russian ADRs, and, you know, none or over the counter type situations where that can make sense. But, you know, again, don't try and get rich on one single trade is what I tell everybody.
Yeah, well, I would imagine like a Canadian oil company stock, or, you know, CSX, Canadian. There's a kind of like the Canadian version of Burlington.
Yeah, Canadian Pacific.
That's what I was struggling with. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I heard, you know, years past that was a great stock to invest in.
Sure. Certainly the Canadian oil sand stocks, mm-hmm. for a while were very hot. You know, anything, you know, they're much more resource stock based, you know, up there. So, you know, a lot of the gold companies trade like that. You know, some of the other stocks, I mean, they tend to be less technology driven, but I mean, there've been some good ones out there. Certainly, BlackBerry was one that was Canadian.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Okay.
So Bill, if someone wants to get in contact with you, what is the very best way to do so?
Best way, always happy to give us a call. I'm at 360-735-1900. Check out our website, beaconrwa.com. Catch me up on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, all that. Always happy to talk to people.
So the usual suspects.
The usual suspects. And Michael, how should people get a hold of you?
Well, the best way for me personally is with my cell phone, 360-609-1775. One of these days I'm going to remember my website, because I just recently changed it. And I am also on social media, but primarily on Facebook. I like to post dad jokes on Facebook. I get a lot of positive feedback from that, so that's something that I've been doing.
I've seen it.
I got a fresh batch.
Oh, good. Working on. Oh, good.
Torment people with. So, but yeah, my cell phone is usually the best way to get in contact with me.
Excellent. Well, you know, best thing to do in any walk of life is don't take yourself too seriously.
And bring enjoyment to others. That's what the purpose is, you know, because I get comments that, oh, that one was a real groaner, but it made me laugh.
Made you laugh.
Mission accomplished then.
There you go.
You know, so this, you know, we're still in a pandemic and, you know, there's still some unrest.
Well, you know, we're still in life.
Yeah, and so, you know, I'd like to divert people's attention off of all the struggles of life and make them laugh and bring a smile to their face. And, you know, so that's what I try to do.
You're a good man. Thank you, Michael.
Well, you're a great man. So thank you, everyone.